netted Andy and Charlie at Tashmore Pond. He told him about the blackout and Rainbird's inspired first step on the road to getting Charlie to start lighting fires under test conditions. Finally, he told Andy that Rainbird's personal interest in all of this was Charlie's life when the string of deception had finally run itself out. He spoke of these matters in a voice that was emotionless, yet somehow urgent. Then he fell silent. Andy listened in growing fury and horror. He was trembling all over when Cap's recitation had concluded. "Charlie," he thought. "Oh, Charlie. Charlie." His 10 minutes were almost up, and there was still so much he needed to know. The two of them sat silent for perhaps 40 seconds. An observer might have decided they were companionable older friends who no longer needed to speak to communicate. Andy's mind raced. "Captain Hollister," he said. "Yes?" "When is Pinchot's funeral?"
"The day after tomorrow," Cap said calmly.
"We're going. You and I, you understand?"
"Yes, I understand. We're going to Pinchot's funeral."
"I asked to go. I broke down and cried when I heard he was dead."
"Yes, you broke down and cried."
"I was very upset."
"Yes, you were."
"We're going to go in your private car, just the two of us. There can be shop people in cars ahead and behind us, motorcycles on either side if that's standard operating procedure. But we're going alone. Do you understand?"
"Oh, yes. That's perfectly clear. Just the two of us."
"And we're going to have a good talk. Do you also understand that?"
"Yes, a good talk."
"Is your car bugged?"
"Not at all."
Andy began to push again, a series of light taps. Each time he pushed, Cap flinched a little, and Andy knew there was an excellent chance that he might be starting an echo in there, but it had to be done. "We're going to talk about where Charlie is being kept. We're going to talk about ways of throwing this whole place into confusion without locking all the doors the way the power blackout did, and we're going to talk about ways that Charlie and I can get out of here. Do you understand?"
"You're not supposed to escape," Cap said in a hateful, childish voice. "That's not in the scenario."
"It is now," Andy said and pushed again.
"Ah!"
Cap whined. "Do you understand that?"
"Yes, I understand. Don't do that anymore. It hurts."
"Is Hockstetter? Will he question my going to the funeral?"
"No, Hockstetter is all wrapped up in the little girl. He thinks of little else these days."
"Good." It wasn't good at all. It was desperation. "Last thing, Captain Hollister, you're going to forget that we had this little talk."
"Yes, I'm going to forget all about it."
The black horse was loose. It was starting its run. "Take me out of here," Andy thought dimly. "Take me out of here. The horse is loose and the woods are burning." The headache came in a sickish cycle of thudding pain.
"Everything I've told you will occur naturally to you as your own idea."
"Yes." Andy looked at Cap's desk and saw a box of Kleenex there. He took one of them and began dabbing at his eyes with it. He was not crying, but the headache had caused his eyes to water, and that was just as good. "I'm ready to go now," he said to Cap. He let go. Cap looked out at the alders again, thoughtfully blank. Little by little, animation came back into his face, and he turned toward Andy, who was wiping at his eyes a bit and sniffling. There was no need to overact.
"How are you feeling now, Andy?"
"A little better," Andy said. "But, you know, to hear it like that."
"Yes, you were very upset," Cap said.
"Would you like to have a coffee or something?"
"No, thanks. I'd like to go back to my apartment, please."
"Of course. I'll see you out."
"Thank you."
22.
The two men who had seen him up to the office looked at Andy with doubtful suspicion. The Kleenex, the red and watering eyes, the paternal arm that Cap had put around his shoulders. Much the same expression came into the eyes of Cap's secretary.
"He broke down and cried when he heard Pinchot was dead," Cap said quietly. "He was very upset. I believe I'll see if I can arrange for him to attend Herman's funeral with me. Would you like to do that, Andy?"
"Yes," Andy said. "Yes, please, if it can be arranged. Poor Dr. Pinchot." And suddenly he burst into real tears. The two men led him past Senator Thompson's bewildered, embarrassed aide, who had several blue-bound folders in his hands.
They took Andy out, still weeping, each with a hand clasped lightly at his elbow. Each of them wore an expression of disgust that was very similar to Cap's. Disgust for this fat drug addict who had totally lost control of his emotions and any sense of perspective, and gushed tears for the man who had been his captor. Andy's tears were real, but it was Charlie he wept for. John always rode with her, but in her dreams Charlie rode alone. The head groom, Peter Drabble, had fitted her out with a small, neat English saddle, but in her dreams she rode bareback. She and John rode on the bridle paths that wove their way across the shop grounds, moving in and out of the toy forest of sugar pines and skirting the duck pond, never doing more than an easy canter, but in her dreams she and Necromancer galloped together, faster and faster, through a real forest. They plunged at speed down a wild trail, and the light was green through the interlaced branches overhead, and her hair streamed out behind her. She could feel the ripple of Necromancer's muscles under his silky hide, and she rode with her hands twisted in his mane and whispered in his ear that she wanted to go faster, faster, faster. Necromancer responded. His hooves were thunder. The path through these tangled green woods was a tunnel, and from somewhere behind her there came a faint crackling and, the woods are burning, a whiff of smoke. It was a fire she had started, but there was no guilt, only exhilaration. They could outrace it. Necromancer could go anywhere, do anything. They would escape the forest tunnel. She could sense brightness ahead. Faster, faster! The exhilaration, the freedom. She could no longer tell where her thighs ended and Necromancer's sides began. They were one, fused as the metal she welded with her power when she did their tests. Ahead of them was a huge deadfall, a blowdown of white wood like a tangled cairn of bones. Wild with lunatic joy, she kicked at Necromancer lightly with her bare heels and felt his hindquarters bunch. They leaped it, for a moment floating in the air. Her head was back, her hands held horsehair, and she screamed, not in fear, but simply because not to scream, to hold in, might cause her to explode. Free! 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 Necromancer, I love you! They cleared the deadfall easily, but now the smell of smoke was sharper, clearer. There was a popping sound from behind them, and it was only when a spark spiraled down and briefly stung her flesh like a nettle before going out that she realized she was naked. Naked and, but the woods are burning, free, unfettered, loose. She and Necromancer running for the light. Faster, she whispered. Faster, oh please. Somehow, the big black gelding produced even more speed. The wind in Charlie's ears was rushing thunder. She didn't have to breathe. Air was scooped into her throat through her half-open mouth. Sun shone through these old trees and dusty bars like old copper. And up ahead was the light. The end of the forest, open land, where she and Necromancer would run forever. The fire was behind them, the hateful smell of smoke, the feel of fear. The sun was ahead, and she would ride Necromancer all the way to the sea, where she would perhaps find her father, and the two of them would live by pulling in nets full of shining, slippery fish. Faster! She cried triumphantly. Oh, Necromancer, go faster! Go faster! Go! And that was when the silhouette stepped into the widening funnel of light where the woods ended, blocking the light in its own shape, blocking the way out. At first, as always in this dream, she thought it was her father, was sure it was her father, and her joy became almost hurtful, before suddenly transforming into utter terror. She just had time to register the fact that the man was too big, too tall, and yet somehow familiar, dreadfully familiar, even in silhouette. Before Necromancer reared, screaming. Can horses scream? I didn't know they could scream. Struggling to stay on, her thighs slipping as his hooves pawed at the air. And he wasn't screaming. He was whinnying, but it was a scream, and there were other screaming whinnies somewhere behind her. Oh, dear God, she thought, horses back there, horses back there, and the woods are burning. Up ahead, blocking the light, that silhouette, that dreadful shape. Now it began to come toward her. She had fallen onto the path, and Necromancer touched her bare stomach gently with his muzzle. "Don't you hurt my horse!" she screamed at the advancing silhouette, the dream father who was not her father. "Don't you hurt the horses! Oh, please don't hurt the horses!" But the figure came on, and it was drawing a gun. And that was when she awoke, sometimes with a scream, sometimes only in a shuddery cold sweat, knowing that she had dreamed badly, but unable to remember anything save the mad, exhilarating plunge down the wooded trail and the smell of fire. These things, and an almost sick feeling of betrayal. And in the stable that day, she would touch Necromancer, or perhaps put the side of her face against his warm shoulder, and feel a dread for which she had no name. Endgame. 1. It was a bigger room. Until last week, in fact, it had been the shop's non-denominational chapel. The speed with which things were picking up could have been symbolized by the speed and ease with which Cap had ran through Hochstetter's requests. A new chapel, not an odd spare room, but a real chapel, was to be built at the eastern end of the grounds. Meanwhile, the remainder of the tests on Charlie McGee would be held here. The fake wood paneling and the pews had been ripped out. Both flooring and walls had been insulated with asbestos batting that looked like steel wool and then covered over with heavy-gauge tempered sheet steel. The area that had been the altar and the nave had been partitioned off. Hochstetter's monitoring instruments and a computer terminal had been installed. All of this had been done in a single week. Work had begun just 4 days before Herman Pinchot ended his life in such grisly fashion. Now, at 2 in the afternoon on an early October day, a cinder block wall stood in the middle of the long room. To the left of it was a huge low tank of water. Into this tank, which was 6 feet deep, had been dumped more than 2,000 pounds of ice. In front of it stood Charlie McGee, looking small and neat in a blue denim jumper and red and black striped rugby socks. Blonde pigtails tied off with small black velvet bows hung down to her shoulder blades. "All right, Charlie," Hochstetter's voice said over the intercom. Like everything else, the intercom had been hastily installed, and its reproduction was tinny and poor. "We're ready when you are." The cameras filmed it all in living color. In these films, the small girl's head dips slightly, and for a few seconds nothing happens at all. Inset at the left of the film frame is a digital temperature readout. All at once, it begins to move upward from 70 to 80 to 90. After that, the figures jump up so rapidly that they are just a shifting reddish blur. The electronic temperature probe has been placed in the center of the cinder block wall. Now the film switches to slow motion. It's the only way that the entire action can be caught. To the men who watched it through the observation room's leaded glass viewing ports, it happened with the speed of a gunshot. In extreme slow motion, the cinder block wall begins to smoke. Small particles of mortar and concrete begin to jump lazily upward like popping corn. Then the mortar holding the blocks together can be observed to be running like warm molasses. Then the bricks begin to crumble from the center outward. Showers of particles, then clouds of them, blow back as the blocks explode with the heat. Now the digital heat sensor implanted in the center of this wall freezes at a reading of over 7,000 degrees. It freezes not because the temperature has stopped climbing, but because the sensor itself has been destroyed. Set around this testing room that used to be a chapel are 8 huge Kelvinator air conditioners, all running at high speed, all pumping freezing air into the testing room. All 8 kicked into operation as soon as the room's overall temperature passed 95. Charlie had got very good at directing the stream of heat that somehow came from her at a single point, but as anyone who has ever burned his or her hand on a hot skillet handle knows, even so-called non-conductible surfaces will conduct heat, if there is enough heat to conduct. With all 8 of the industrial Kelvinators running, the temperature in the testing room should have been minus 15 degrees Fahrenheit, plus or minus 5 degrees. Instead, the records show a continued climb, up over 100 degrees, then 105, then 107. But all of the sweat running down the faces of the observers cannot be accounted for by the heat alone. Now not even extreme slow motion will give a clear picture of what is happening, but one thing is clear. As the cinder blocks continue to explode outward and backward, there can be no doubt that they are burning. These blocks are burning as briskly as newspapers in a fireplace. Of course, an eighth-grade science book teaches that anything will burn if it gets hot enough, but it is one thing to read such information, and quite another to see cinder block blazing with blue and yellow flame. Then everything is obscured by a furious blowback of disintegrating particles as the whole wall vaporizes. The little girl makes a slow-motion half-turn, and a moment later, the calm surface of the icy water in the tank is convulsed and boiling, and the heat in the room, which has crested at 112, even with all 8 air conditioners, it is as hot as a summer noontime in Death Valley, begins to go back. There's one for the sweeper. Two. Interdepartmental memo. From Bradford Hayek to Patrick Hochstetter. Date, October 2nd. Regarding telemetry, latest C. McGee test number 4. Pat, I've watched the films 4 times now and still can't believe it isn't some sort of special effects trick. Some unsolicited advice? When you get before the Senate subcommittee that's going to deal with the Lot 6 appropriations and renewal plans, have your ducks in a row and do more than cover your ass. Armor plate it. Human nature being what it is, those guys are going to look at those films and have a hard job believing it isn't a flat-out shuck and jive. To business. The readouts are being delivered by special messenger, and this memo should beat them by no more than 2 or 3 hours. You can read them over for yourself, but I'll briefly sum up our findings. Our conclusions can be summed up in 2 words. We're stumped. She was wired up this time like an astronaut going into space. You will note, 1, blood pressure within normal parameters for a child of 8, and there's hardly a jog when that wall goes up like the Hiroshima bomb. 2, abnormally high alpha wave readings. What we'd call her imagination circuitry is well engaged. You may or may not agree with Clapper and me that the waves are rather more even, suggesting a certain controlled imaginative dexterity. Clapper's rather a fulsome phrase, not mine. Could indicate she's getting in control of it and can manipulate the ability with greater precision. Practice, as they say, makes perfect, or it may mean nothing at all. 3. All metabolic telemetry is within normal parameters, nothing strange or out of place. It's as if she was reading a good book or writing a class theme instead of creating what you say must have been upwards of 30,000 degrees of spot heat. To my mind, the most fascinating and frustrating information of all is the Beal-Searles cat test. Next to no caloric burn. In case you've forgotten your physics, occupational hazard with you shrinks, a calorie is nothing but a unit of heat. The amount of heat necessary to raise a gram of water 1 degree centigrade, to be exact. She burned maybe 25 calories during that little exhibition, what we would burn doing a half a dozen sit-ups or walking twice around the building. But calories measure heat, damn it, heat! And what she's producing is heat. Or is she? Is it coming from her or through her? And if it's the latter, where is it coming from? Figure that one out and you've got the Nobel Prize in your hip pocket. I'll tell you this. If our test series is as limited as you say it is, I'm positive we'll never find out. Last word. Are you sure you want to continue these tests? Lately, I just have to think about that kid, and I start to get very antsy. I start thinking about things like pulsars and neutrinos and black holes and Christ knows what else. There are forces loose in this universe that we don't even know about yet, and some we can observe only at a remove of millions of light years. And breathe a sigh of relief because of it. The last time I looked at that film, I began to think of the girl as a crack, a chink, if you like, in the very smelter of creation. I know how that sounds, but I feel I would be remiss not to say it. God forgive me for saying this, with 3 lovely girls of my own, but I personally will breathe a sigh of relief when she's been neutralized. If she can produce 30,000 degrees of spot heat, without even trying. Have you ever thought what might happen if she really set her mind to it? Brad. 3. I want to see my father, Charlie said when Hochstetter came in. She looked pale and wan. She had changed from her jumper into an old nightgown, and her hair was loose on her shoulders. Charlie, he began, but anything he had been meaning to follow with was suddenly gone. He was deeply troubled by Brad Hayek's memo and by the supporting telemetry readouts. The fact that Brad had trusted those final two paragraphs to print said much and suggested more. Hockstetter himself was scared. In authorizing the changeover of chapel to testing room, Cap had also authorized the installation of more Kelvinator air conditioners around Charlie's apartment. Not 8, but 20. Only 6 had been installed so far, but after test number 4, Hockstetter didn't care if they were installed or not. He thought they could set up 200 of the damn things and not impede her power. It was no longer a question of whether or not she could kill herself. It was a question of whether or not she could destroy the entire shop installation if she wanted to, and maybe all of Eastern Virginia in the bargain. Hockstetter now thought that if she wanted to do those things, she could. And the last stop on that line of reasoning was even scarier. Only John Rainbird had an effective check rein on her now. And Rainbird was nuts. "I want to see my father," she repeated. Her father was at the funeral of poor Herman Pinchot. He attended with Cap at the latter's request. Even Pinchot's death, as unrelated to anything going on here as it was, seemed to have cast its own evil pall over Hockstetter's mind. "Well, I think that can be arranged," Hockstetter said cautiously. "If you can show us a little more..." "I've shown you enough," she said. "I want to see my daddy." Her lower lip trembled. Her eyes had taken on a sheen of tears. "You're orderly," Hockstetter said. "That Indian fellow said you didn't want to go for a ride on your horse this morning after the test. He seemed worried about you." "It's not my horse," Charlie said. Her voice was husky. "Nothing here is mine. Nothing except my daddy, and I want to see him." Her voice rose to an angry, tearful shout. "Don't get excited, Charlie," Hockstetter said, suddenly frightened. Was it suddenly getting hotter in here, or was it just his imagination? Just don't get excited. Rainbird. This should have been Rainbird's job, goddammit. "Listen to me, Charlie." He smiled a wide, friendly smile. "How would you like to go to Six Flags Over Georgia? It's just about the neatest amusement park in the whole South, except maybe for Disney World. We'd rent the whole park for a day, just for you. You could ride the Ferris wheel, go in the Haunted Mansion, the merry-go-round." "I don't want to go to any amusement park. I just want to see my daddy, and I'm going to. I hope you hear me, because I'm going to." It was hotter. "You're sweating," Charlie said. He thought of the cinder block wall exploding so fast you could see the flames only in slow motion. He thought of the steel tray flipping over twice as it flew across the room, spraying burning chunks of wood. If she flicked that power out at him, he would be a pile of ashes and fused bone almost before he knew what was happening to him. "Oh, God, please. Charlie, getting mad at me won't accomplish anything." "Yes," she said with perfect truth. "Yes, it will, and I'm mad at you, Dr. Hockstetter. I'm really mad at you." "Charlie, please, I want to see him," she said again. "Now go away. You tell them I want to see my father, and then they can test me some more if they want. I don't mind. But if I don't see him, I'll make something happen. Tell them that." He left. He felt that he should say something more, something that would redeem his dignity a little, make up a little for the fear. "You're sweating," she had seen scrawled on his face, but nothing occurred. He left, and not even the steel door between him and her could completely ease his fear, or his anger at John Rainbird, because Rainbird had foreseen this, and Rainbird had said nothing. And if he accused Rainbird of that, the Indian would only smile his chilling smile and ask who was the psychiatrist around here anyway. The tests had diminished her complex about starting fires until it was like an earthen dam that had sprung leaks in a dozen places. The tests had afforded her the practice necessary to refine a crude sledgehammer of power into something she could flick out with deadly precision, like a circus performer throwing a weighted knife. And the tests had been the perfect object lesson. They had shown her, beyond a shadow of a doubt, who was in charge here. She was. 4. When Hockstetter was gone, Charlie fell on the couch, her hands to her face, sobbing. Waves of conflicting emotion swept her, guilt and horror, indignation, even a kind of angry pleasure. But fear was the greatest of them all. Things had changed when she agreed to their tests. She feared things had changed forever. And now she didn't just want to see her father, she needed him. She needed him to tell her what to do next. At first, there had been rewards. Walks outside with John, currying Necromancer, then riding him. She loved John, and she loved Necromancer. If that stupid man could only have known how badly he had hurt her by saying Necromancer was hers, when Charlie knew he never could be. The big gelding was only hers in her uneasy, half-remembered dreams. But now, the tests themselves, the chance to use her power and feel it grow, that was starting to become the reward. It had become a terrible but compelling game, and she sensed she had barely scratched the surface. She was like a baby who has just learned how to walk. She needed her father. She needed him to tell her what was right, what was wrong, whether to go on or to stop forever. If I can stop, she whispered through her fingers. That was the most frightening thing of all, no longer being sure that she could stop. And if she could not, what would that mean? Oh, what would that mean? She began to cry again. She had never felt so dreadfully alone. Five. The funeral was a bad scene. Andy had thought he would be okay. His headache was gone, and after all, the funeral was only an excuse to be alone with Cap. He hadn't liked Pinchot, although in the end Pinchot had proved to be just a little too small to hate. His barely concealed arrogance and his unconcealed pleasure at being on top of a fellow human being, because of those things and because of his overriding concern for Charlie, Andy had felt little guilt about the ricochet that he had inadvertently set up in Pinchot's mind, the ricochet that had finally torn the man apart. The echo effect had happened before, but he had always had a chance to put things right again. It was something he had got pretty good at by the time he and Charlie had to run from New York City. There seemed to be landmines planted deep in almost every human brain, deep-seated fears and guilts, suicidal, schizophrenic, paranoid impulses, even murderous ones. A push caused a state of extreme suggestibility, and if a suggestion tended down one of those dark paths, it could destroy. One of his housewives in the wait-off program had begun to suffer frightening catatonic lapses. One of his businessmen had confessed a morbid urge to take his service pistol down from the closet and play Russian roulette with it, an urge that was somehow connected in his mind with a story by Edgar Allan Poe, William Wilson, that he had read way back in high school. In both cases, Andy had been able to stop the echo before it sped up and turned into that lethal ricochet. In the case of the businessman, a quiet, sandy-haired, third-echelon bank officer, all it had taken was another push and the quiet suggestion that he had never read the Poe story at all. The connection, whatever it had been, was broken. The chance to break the echo had never come with Pinchot. Cap talked restlessly of the man's suicide as they drove to the funeral through a cold, swishing autumn rain. He seemed to be trying to come to terms with it. He said he wouldn't have thought it possible for a man just to keep his arm in there once those blades had begun to chop and grind. But Pinchot had. Somehow Pinchot had. That was when the funeral started being bad for Andy. The two of them attended only the graveside services, standing well back from the small group of friends and family, clustered under a bloom of black umbrellas. Andy discovered it was one thing to remember Pinchot's arrogance, the little Caesar power-tripping of a small man who had no real power, to remember his endless and irritating nervous tick of a smile. It was quite another to look at his pallid, washed-out wife in her black suit and veiled hat, holding the hands of her two boys. The younger was about Charlie's age, and they both looked utterly stunned and out of it, as if drugged, knowing, as she must, that the friends and relatives must all know how her husband was found, dressed in her underwear, his right arm vaporized nearly to the elbow, sharpened like a living pencil, his blood splattered in the sink and on the wood-mowed cabinets, chunks of his flesh. Andy's gorge rose helplessly. He bent forward in the cold rain, struggling with it. The minister's voice rose and fell senselessly.
"I want to go," Andy said. "Can we go?"
"Yes, of course," Cap said. He looked pale himself, old and not particularly well.
"I've been to quite enough funerals this year to hold me."
They slipped away from the group standing around the fake grass, the flowers already drooping and spilling petals in this hard rain, the coffin on its runners over the hole in the ground. They walked side by side back toward the winding gravel drive, where Cap's economy-sized Chevy was parked near the rear of the funeral cortege. They walked under willows that dripped and rustled mysteriously. Three or four other men, barely seen, moved around them. Andy thought that he must know now how the President of the United States feels.
"Very bad for the widow and the little boys," Cap said. "The scandal, you know.
Will she be taken care of?"
"Very handsomely in terms of money," Cap said almost tonelessly.
They were nearing the lane now. Andy could see Cap's orange Vega parked on the verge. Two men were getting quietly into a Biscayne in front of it. Two more got into a gray Plymouth behind it.
"But nobody's going to be able to buy off those two little boys. Did you see their faces?"
Andy said nothing. Now he felt guilt. It was like a sharp saw blade working in his guts. Not even telling himself that his own position had been desperate would help. All he could do now was hold Charlie's face in front of him. Charlie, and a darkly ominous figure behind her, the one-eyed pirate named John Rainbird, who had wormed his way into her confidence so he could hasten the day when... They got into the Vega and Cap started the engine. The Biscayne ahead pulled out and Cap followed. The Plymouth fell into place behind them. Andy felt a sudden, almost eerie certainty that the push had deserted him again, that when he tried there would be nothing, as if to pay for the expression on the faces of the two boys. But what else was there to do but try?
"We're going to have a little talk," he said to Cap, and pushed.
The push was there, and the headache settled in almost at once, the price he was going to have to pay for using it so soon after the last time. "It won't interfere with your driving." Cap seemed to settle in his seat. His left hand, which had been moving toward his turn signal, hesitated a moment and then went on. The Vega followed the lead car sedately between the big stone pillars and onto the main road.
"No, I don't think our little talk will interfere with my driving at all," Cap said.
They were 20 miles from the compound. Andy had checked the odometer upon leaving and again upon arriving at the cemetery. A lot of it was over the highway Pinchot had told him about, 301. It was a fast road. He guessed he had no more than 25 minutes to arrange everything. He had thought of little else over the last 2 days and thought he had everything pretty well mapped out, but there was one thing he badly needed to know. "How long can you and Rainbird ensure Charlie's cooperation, Captain Hollister?"
"Not much longer," Cap said. "Rainbird arranged things very cleverly so that in your absence he's the only one really in control of her, the father's surrogate."
In a low, almost chanting voice, he said,
"He's her father when her father isn't there."
"And when she stops, she's to be killed?"
"Not immediately.
Rainbird can keep her at it a while longer." Cap signaled his turn onto 301.
"He'll pretend we found out that they were talking, found out that he was giving her advice on how to handle her, her problem, found out he had passed notes to you."
He fell silent. But Andy didn't need any more. He felt sick. He wondered if they had congratulated each other on how easy it was to fool a little kid, to win her affections in a lonely place, and then twist her to their own purposes once they had earned her trust. When nothing else would work, just tell her that her only friend, John the Orderly, was going to lose his job and maybe be prosecuted under the Official Secrets Act for presuming to be her friend. Charlie would do the rest on her own. Charlie would deal with them. She would continue to cooperate. "I hope I meet this guy soon. I really do." But there was no time to think about that now, and if things went right, he would never have to meet Rainbird at all. "I'm slated to go to Hawaii a week from today," Andy said.
"Yes, that's right."
"How?"
"By Army transport plane."
"Who did you contact to arrange that?"
"Puck,"
Cap said immediately.
"Who's Puck, Captain Hollister?"
"Major Victor Puckridge," Cap said, "at Andrews."
"Andrews Air Force Base?" Yes, of course.
He's a friend? We play golf.
Cap smiled vaguely.
He slices.
Wonderful news, Andy thought. His head was throbbing like a rotted tooth.
Suppose you called him this afternoon and said you wanted to move that flight up by 3 days.
Yes, Cap said doubtfully.
Would that present a problem? A lot of paperwork?
Oh, no, Puck would slice right through the paperwork.
The smile reappeared, slightly odd and not really happy.
He slices, did I tell you that?
Yes, yes you did.
Oh, good.
The car hummed along at a perfectly legal 55. The rain had mellowed to a steady mist. The windshield wipers clicked back and forth.
Call him this afternoon, Cap, as soon as you get back.
Call Puck, yes. I was just thinking I ought to do that.
Tell him I've got to be moved on Wednesday instead of Saturday.
4 days was not much time to recuperate. 3 weeks would have been more like it, but things were moving rapidly to a climax now. The endgame had begun. The fact was there, and Andy, out of necessity, recognized it. He wouldn't, couldn't, leave Charlie in the path of this rainbird creature any longer than he had to. Wednesday instead of Saturday.
Yes, and then you tell Puck that you'll be coming along.
Coming along? I can't.
Andy renewed the push.
It hurt him, but he pushed hard.
Cap jerked in his seat. The car swerved minutely on the road, and Andy thought again that he was practically begging to start up an echo in this guy's head.
Coming along. Yes, I'm coming along.
That's right, Andy said grimly.
Now, what sort of arrangements have you made about security?
No particular security arrangements, Cap said. You're pretty much incapacitated by Thorazine. Also, you're tipped over and unable to use your mental domination ability. It has become dormant.
Yes, Andy said, and put a slightly shaky hand to his forehead.
Do you mean I'll be riding the plane alone?
No, Cap said immediately. I believe I'll come along myself.
Yes, but other than the two of us.
There will be two shopmen along, partly to act as stewards, and partly to keep an eye on you.
SOP, you know. Protect the investment.
Only two operatives are scheduled to go with us, you're sure?
Yes.
And the flight crew, of course.
Yes.
Andy looked out the window. They were halfway back now.
This was the crucial part, and his head was already aching so badly that he was afraid he might forget something. If he did, the whole cart house would come tumbling down.
Charlie, he thought, and tried to hold on. Hawaii is a long way from Virginia, Captain Hollister. Will the plane make a refueling stop?
Yes.
Do you know where?
No,
Cap said serenely, and Andy could have punched him in the eye.
When you speak to... what was his name?
He groped frantically in his tired, hurt mind and retrieved it.
When you speak to Puck, find out where the plane will set down for refueling.
Yes, all right.
Just work it naturally into your conversation with him.
Yes, I'll find out where it's going to refuel by working it naturally into our conversation.
He glanced at Andy with thoughtful, dreamy eyes, and Andy found himself wondering if this man had given the order that Vicky be killed.
There was a sudden urge to tell him to floor the accelerator pedal and drive into that oncoming bridge abutment.
Except for Charlie.
Charlie, his mind said. Hold on for Charlie.
Did I tell you that Puck slices? Cap said fondly.
Yes, you did.
Think. Think, damn it. Somewhere near Chicago or Los Angeles seemed the most likely. But not at a civilian airport like O'Hare or L.A. International. The plane would refuel at an airbase.
That in itself presented no problem to his rag of a plan. It was one of the few things that did not, as long as he could find out where in advance.
"We'd like to leave at 3 p.m, he told Cap.
3.
You'll see that this John Rainbird is somewhere else.
Send him away, Cap said hopefully, and it gave Andy a chill to realize that Cap was afraid of Rainbird. Quite badly afraid.
Yes, it doesn't matter where.
San Diego?
All right.
Now, last lap. He was just going to make it. Up ahead, a green reflectorized sign pointed the way to the Longmont exit. Andy reached into the front pocket of his pants and pulled out a folded slip of paper. For the moment, he only held it in his lap, between first and second fingers. "You're going to tell the two shop guys who are going to Hawaii with us to meet us at the airbase," he said.
"They're to meet us at Andrews. You and I will go to Andrews just as we are now."
"Yes."
Andy drew in a deep breath. "But my daughter will be with us."
"Her?"
Cap showed real agitation for the first time.
"Her, she's dangerous. She can't. We can't."
"She wasn't dangerous until you people started playing with her," Andy said harshly. "Now she is coming with us, and you are not to contradict me again. Do you understand that?" This time the car's swerve was more pronounced, and Cap moaned.
"She'll be coming with us," he agreed. "I won't contradict you anymore. That hurts. That hurts.
But not as much as it hurts me." Now his voice seemed to be coming from far away, through the blood-soaked net of pain that was pulling tighter and tighter around his brain. "You're going to give her this," Andy said, and passed the folded note to Cap. "Give it to her today, but do it carefully so that no one suspects." Cap tucked the note into his breast pocket. Now they were approaching the shop. On their left were the double runs of electrified fence. Warning signs flashed past every 50 yards or so. "Repeat back the salient points," Andy said. Cap spoke quickly and concisely, the voice of a man who had been trained in the act of recall since the days of his military academy boyhood. "I will arrange for you to leave for Hawaii on an army transport plane on Wednesday instead of Saturday. I will be coming with you. Your daughter will also accompany us. The two shop agents who will also be coming will meet us at Andrews. I will find out from Puck where the plane will be refueling. I'll do that when I call him to change the flight date. I have a note to give your daughter. I'll give it to her after I finish talking to Puck, and I will do it in a way which will arouse no undue suspicion. And I will arrange to have John Rainbird in San Diego next Wednesday. I believe that covers the waterfront."
"Yes," Andy said. "I believe it does."
He leaned back against the seat and closed his eyes. Jumbled fragments of past and present flew through his mind aimlessly, jackstraws blown in a high wind. Did this really have a chance to work, or was he only buying death for both of them? They knew what Charlie could do now. They'd had first-hand experience. If it went wrong, they would finish their trip in the cargo bay of that army transport plane, in two boxes. Cap paused at the guard booth, rolled down his window, and handed over a plastic card, which the man on duty slipped into a computer terminal.
"Go ahead, sir,"
he said. Cap drove on. "One last thing, Captain Hollister. You're going to forget all about this. You'll do each of the things we've discussed perfectly spontaneously. You'll discuss them with no one."
"All right."
Andy nodded. It wasn't all right, but it would have to do. The chances of setting up an echo here were extraordinarily high because he had been forced to push the man terribly hard, and also because the instructions he had given Cap would go completely against the grain. Cap might be able to bring everything off simply by virtue of his position here. He might not. Right now Andy was too tired and in too much pain to care much. He was barely able to get out of the car. Cap had to take his arm to steady him. He was dimly aware that the cold autumn drizzle felt good against his face. The two men from the Biscayne looked at him with a kind of cold disgust. One of them was Don Jules. Jules was wearing a blue sweatshirt that read, "U.S. Olympic Drinking Team." "Get a good look at the stoned fat man," Andy thought groggily. He was close to tears again, and his breath began to catch and hitch in his throat. "You get a good look now, because if the fat guy gets away this time, he's going to blow this whole rotten cesspool right out of the swamp."
"There, there," Cap said,
and patted him on the shoulder with patronizing and perfunctory sympathy. "Just do your job," Andy thought, holding on grimly against the tears. He would not cry in front of them again, none of them. "Just do your job, you son of a bitch."
6. Back in his apartment, Andy stumbled to his bed, hardly aware of what he was doing, and fell asleep. He lay like a dead thing for the next 6 hours, while blood seeped from a minute rupture in his brain and a number of brain cells grew white and died. When he woke up, it was 10 o'clock in the evening. The headache was still raging. His hands went to his face. The numb spots, one below his left eye, one on his left cheekbone, and one just below the jawbone, were back. This time, they were bigger. I can't push it much farther without killing myself, he thought, and knew it was true. But he would hold on long enough to see this through, to give Charlie her chance, if he possibly could. Somehow, he would hold on that long. He went to the bathroom and got a glass of water. Then he lay down again, and after a long time, sleep returned. His last waking thought was that Charlie must have read his note by now. Seven. Cap Hollister had had an extremely busy day since getting back from Herm Pinchot's funeral. He had no more than got settled into his office when his secretary brought him an interdepartmental memo marked Urgent. It was from Pat Hochstetter. Cap told her to get him Vic Puckeridge on the phone and settled back to read the memo. I should get out more often, he thought. It aerates the brain cells or something. It had occurred to him on the ride back that there was really no sense waiting a whole week to ship McGee off to Maui. This Wednesday would be plenty late enough. Then the memo captured his whole attention. It was miles from Hochstetter's usual cool and rather baroque style. In fact, it was couched in nearly hysterical purple prose, and Cap thought with some amusement that the kid must have really hit Hochstetter with the chicken stick, hit him hard. What it came down to was that Charlie had dug in her heels. It had come sooner than they had expected, that was all. Maybe, no, probably even sooner than Rainbird had expected. Well, they would let it lie for a few days, and then... His train of thought broke up. His eyes took on a faraway, slightly puzzled cast. In his mind, he saw a golf club, a five-iron, whistling down and connecting solidly with a Spalding ball. He could hear that low, whistling whoop sound. Then the ball was gone, high and white against the blue sky. But it was slicing. Slicing. His brow cleared. What had he been thinking of? It wasn't like him to wander off the subject like that. Charlie had dug in her heels. That was what he had been thinking. Well, that was all right. Nothing to get bent out of shape about. They would let her alone for a while, until the weekend maybe, and then they could use Rainbird on her. She would light a lot of fires to keep Rainbird out of Dutch. His hand stole to his breast pocket and felt the small paper folded in there. In his mind, he heard the soft, swinging sound of a golf club again. It seemed to reverberate in the office. But now it was not a whoop sound, it was a quiet sss, almost the sound of a snake. That was unpleasant. He had always found snakes unpleasant, ever since earliest childhood. With an effort, he swept all this foolishness about snakes and golf clubs from his mind. Perhaps the funeral had upset him more than he had thought. The intercom buzzed, and his secretary told him Puck was on line one. Cap picked up the phone and, after some small talk, asked Puck if there would be a problem if they decided to move the Maui shipment up from Saturday to Wednesday. Puck checked and said he saw no problem there at all. Say around 3 p.m? No problem, Puck repeated. Just don't move it up any more or we'll be in the bucket. This place is getting worse than the freeway at rush hour. No, this is solid, Cap said. And here's something else. I'm going along, but you keep that under your hat, okay? Puck burst into a hearty baritone laughter. A little sun, fun, and grass skirts? Why not? Cap agreed. I'm escorting a valuable piece of cargo. I could justify myself in front of a Senate committee if I had to, I think. And I haven't had a real vacation since 1973. The goddamn Arabs and their oil bitched up the last week of that one. I'll keep it to myself, Puck agreed. You gonna play some golf while you're out there? I know of at least 2 great courses on Maui. Cap fell silent. He looked thoughtfully at the top of his desk, through it. The phone sagged away from his ear slightly. Cap? You there? Low and definite and ominous in this small, cozy study. Sss. Shit, I think we've been cut off, Puck muttered. Cap? Cap? You still slicing the ball, old buddy? Cap asked. Puck laughed. You kiddin'? When I die, they're going to bury me in the fucking rough. Thought I lost you for a minute there. I'm right here, Cap said. Puck, are there snakes in Hawaii? Now was Puck's turn to pause.
Say again?
Snakes. Poisonous snakes.
Gee, damn if I know. I can check it for you if it's important.
Puck's dubious tone seemed to imply that Cap employed about 5,000 spooks to check just such things.
No, that's okay, Cap said.
He held the telephone firmly against his ear again.
Just thinking out loud, I guess. Maybe I'm getting old.
Not you, Cap. There's too much vampire in you.
Yeah, maybe. Thanks, good buddy.
No trouble at all. Glad you're getting away for a bit. Nobody deserves it more than you after the last year you've put in.
He meant Georgia, of course. He didn't know about the McGees. Which meant, Cap thought wearily, that he didn't know the half of it.
He started to say goodbye and then added, By the way, Puck, where will that plane be stopping to refuel? Any idea?
Durban, Illinois, Puck said promptly. Outside Chicago.
Cap thanked him, said goodbye, hung up. His fingers went to the note in his pocket again and touched it. His eye fell on Hockstetter's memo. It sounded as if the girl had been pretty upset, too. Perhaps it wouldn't hurt if he went down and spoke to her, stroked her a little. He leaned forward and thumbed the intercom.
Yes, Cap. I'll be going downstairs for a while, he said. I should be back in 30 minutes or so.
Very good. He got up and left the study. As he did so, his hand stole to his breast pocket and felt the note there again. Eight. Charlie lay on her bed 15 minutes after Cap left, her mind in a total whirl of dismay, fear, and confused speculation. She literally didn't know what to think. He had come at 4:45, half an hour ago, and had introduced himself as Captain Hollister. But please just call me Cap, everyone does. He had a kindly, shrewd face that reminded her a little of the illustrations in The Wind in the Willows. It was a face she had seen somewhere recently, but she hadn't been able to place it until Cap jogged her memory. It had been he who had taken her back to her rooms after the first test, when the man in the white suit had bolted, leaving the door open. She had been so much in a fog of shock, guilt, and, yes, exhilarated triumph, that it was really no wonder she hadn't been able to place his face. Probably she could have been escorted back to her apartment by Gene Simmons of Kiss without noticing it. He talked in a smooth, convincing way that she immediately mistrusted. He told her Hockstetter was concerned because she had declared the testing at an end until she saw her father. Charlie agreed that was so and would say no more, maintaining a stubborn silence, mostly out of fear. If you discussed your reasons for things with a smooth talker like this Cap, he would strip those reasons away one by one until it seemed that black was white and white black. The bare demand was better, safer. But he had surprised her. "If that's the way you feel, okay," he had said. The expression of surprise on her face must have been slightly comical because he chuckled. "It will take a bit of arranging, but..." At the words, "a bit of arranging," her face closed up again. "No more fires," she said. "No more tests, even if it takes you 10 years to arrange it." "Oh, I don't think it'll take that long," he had said, not offended. "It's just that I have people to answer to, Charlie. And a place like this runs on paperwork, but you don't have to light so much as a candle while I'm setting it up."
"Good," she said stonily, not believing him, not believing he was going to set anything up, "because I won't.
I think I ought to be able to arrange it by Wednesday." "Yes, by Wednesday for sure."
He had fallen suddenly silent. His head cocked slightly as if he were listening to something just a bit too high-pitched for her to hear. Charlie looked at him puzzled, was about to ask if he was all right, and then closed her mouth with a snap. There was something almost familiar about the way he was sitting.
"Do you really think I could see him on Wednesday?" she asked timidly.
"Yes, I think so," Cap said.
He shifted in his chair and sighed heavily. His eye caught hers, and he smiled a puzzled little smile, also familiar. Apropos of nothing at all, he said,
"Your dad plays a mean game of golf, I hear."
Charlie blinked. So far as she knew, her father had never touched a golf club in his life. She got ready to say so, and then it came together in her mind, and a dizzying burst of bewildered excitement ran through her.
"Mr. Merle! He's like Mr. Merle."
Mr. Merle had been one of Daddy's executives when they were in New York. Just a little man with light blonde hair and pink-rimmed glasses and a sweet, shy smile. He had come to get more confidence, like the rest of them. He worked in an insurance company or a bank or something, and Daddy had been very worried about Mr. Merle for a while. It was a ricochet. It came from using the push. It had something to do with a story Mr. Merle had read once. The push Daddy used to give Mr. Merle more confidence made him remember that story in a bad way, a way that was making him sick. Daddy said the ricochet came from that story, and it was bouncing around in Mr. Merle's head like a tennis ball, only instead of finally stopping the way a bouncing tennis ball would, the memory of that story would get stronger and stronger until it made Mr. Merle very sick. Only Charlie had got the idea that Daddy was afraid it might do more than make Mr. Merle sick. He was afraid it might kill him. So he had kept Mr. Merle after the others left one night and pushed him into believing he had never read that story at all. And after that, Mr. Merle was all right. Daddy told her once that he hoped Mr. Merle would never go to see a movie called The Deer Hunter, but he didn't explain why. But before Daddy fixed him up, Mr. Merle had looked like Cap did now. She was suddenly positive that her father had pushed this man, and the excitement in her was like a tornado. After hearing nothing about him except for the sort of general reports John sometimes brought her, after not seeing him or knowing where he was, it was in a strange way as if her father were suddenly in this room with her, telling her it was all right and that he was near. Cap suddenly stood up. "Well, I'll be going now, but I'll be seeing you, Charlie, and don't worry." She wanted to tell him not to go, to tell her about her dad, where he was, if he was okay, but her tongue was rooted to the bottom of her mouth. Cap went to the door, then paused. "Oh, almost forgot." He crossed the room to her, took a folded piece of paper from his breast pocket, and handed it to her. She took it numbly, looked at it, and put it in her robe pocket. "And when you're out riding that horse, you watch out for snakes," he said confidentially. "If a horse sees a snake, he's going to bolt every time. He'll..." He broke off, raised a hand to his temple, and rubbed it. For a moment he looked old and distracted. Then he shook his head a little, as if dismissing the thought. He bid her goodbye and left. Charlie stood there for a long moment after he was gone. Then she took out the note, unfolded it, read what was written there, and everything changed. Nine. Charlie, love. First thing, when you finish reading this, flush it down the toilet, okay? Second thing, if everything goes the way I'm planning, the way I hope, we'll be out of here next Wednesday. The man who gave you this note is on our team, although he doesn't know he is. Get it? Third thing, I want you to be in the stables on Wednesday afternoon at 1 o'clock. I don't care how you do it. Make another fire for them if that's what it takes, but be there. Fourth, most important thing, don't trust this man, John Rainbird. This may upset you. I know you have trusted him, but he's a very dangerous man, Charlie. No way anyone's going to blame you for your trust in him. Hollister says he has been convincing enough to win an Academy Award, but know this, he was in charge of the men who took us prisoner at Granther's place. I hope this doesn't upset you too much, but knowing how you are, it probably will. It's no fun to find out that someone has been using you for his own purposes. Listen, Charlie, if Rainbird comes around, and he probably will, it is very important for him to think your feelings toward him haven't changed. He will be out of our way on Wednesday afternoon. We are going to Los Angeles or Chicago, Charlie, and I think I know a way to arrange a press conference for us. I have an old friend named Quincy. I'm counting on to help us, and I must believe that he will come through for us if I can get in touch with him. A press conference would mean that the whole country would know about us. They may still want to keep us someplace, but we can be together. I hope you still want that as much as I do. This wouldn't be so bad except that they want you to make fires for all the wrong reasons. If you have any doubts at all about running again, remember it is for the last time, and that it is what your mother would have wanted. I miss you, Charlie, and love you lots. Dad. 10. John? John in charge of the men that shot her and her father with tranquilizer darts? John?
She rolled her head from side to side. The feeling of desolation